Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Ollie.
Hey, Dave.
What's going on today?
Dave, I'm so happy to be sitting here across from you in your cozy house with your cozy Christmas tree. And by cozy, I don't mean small. I mean cozy as in it's so warm and happy here.
Well, that's the atmosphere we try and create here.
Nice job.
Thank you. All right. Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Yeah, right? We made it through another year.
We are heading into 2030, 2040.
Yeah, somewhere. It's the future. We're heading into the future. So welcome to it. It's very exciting. This is our look back. You can't go forward before you, first you got to look back before you head forward. You learn from history, right? So we're going to try and this will be our learning episode. Yeah, what did we learn?
Here's the thing. So you do learn from history, but they say that those that don't acknowledge history are doomed to repeat whatever the saying is. I would be happy if we could have another year like this year. That would be so odd. We had a great year.
Yeah, it was a very good year. We had 37 episodes of new content. We are so much content.
That is a lot. That's a lot. 37 weeks of 52 weeks.
Yes.
That's how many there are in a year.
That's what I hear. That's what history tells us. Yeah, so we divide up our year with first a look back at a year that was. For some reason, we decided to look back at the year that was 1986 in 2023.
You make it sound like there's no more rhyme or reason for that. But we started this podcast 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago, and we started with 1980.
Yeah, we should have started with, what year was it, 2017? We should have started with 1987.
I think it was 2018.
What, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22? No. I'm bad at math. Okay. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at is we're looking at in the future, we're going to look at back at 1987. That's the future, is 1987. The past is 1986. So like last year, 1986, first we looked at the K-Rock countdown of the top 106.7 songs that were played on K-Rock that year. And we broke it down in 10 song chunks. We talked to anybody about that?
Oh, we talked to a lot of people. We like to do this with other radio people who know a lot about the music and just had a good sense of the year.
The people that were there.
Yeah.
They've got personal stories to share.
They do. They knew the artist. They know the music. And we like hearing their stories. So we had a whole host of radio people join us this year.
Yeah, we had a few. We had a couple from 91X in San Diego, Max Tolkoff and Michael Halloran. They were awesome, had amazing stories.
91X was so far ahead of its time back in the day. We were the first station to ever stream a concert. We did a live broadcast at 91X with Pearl Jam, because Eddie grew up on 91X. Pearl Jam had their own little micro transmitter they brought with them, like 100 watts. And they'd set it up outside the building. I had gotten permission from Eddie to patch into their lines right out of the soundboard, pre their transmitter. So we patched in there. And Eddie on stage at one point goes, look, I know that some radio stations in San Diego are broadcasting the show as well. And I just want to make one thing clear. It's on the bootleg somewhere. And he says, I only gave one station permission. So XA, Terea, he starts doing the legal ID in Spanish. Eddie grew up on it. He's like, he knows it. He's doing it in Spanish. Not well, by the way. He kind of fucked it up a little bit. But the insane part about it is that, you know, that's the kind of radio station we have always been is we're there for the artists.
Who else did we talk to?
We talked to Rita Wild, who we'd been wanting to talk to for a long time.
For sure. Yeah. Thank goodness. Yeah. That was great to talk to Rita. Walk This Way, Run DMC. We love Aerosmith. We play everything they do. What about this?
You know, we didn't play the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, kind of like the same thing. It's just like, no, I think maybe it was played once or twice, but then the reaction on the phones was just horrendous.
Okay.
That it was just like that. They just, no, don't do it. I remember the first time we tried to play Depeche Mode. It's like, don't ever play Depeche Mode on KLOS. I mean, people were adamant about that. You know, I warned Dave about that, Dave Beasing it, you know, because he was like playing something. I go, people are going to turn on you. But then you realize that, no, well, Depeche Mode, I mean, you know, they did that whole thing at the Warehouse and the Rose Bowl. And, you know, you can't deny that their impact on Los Angeles. I mean, huge. But, you know, I guess those tried and true rock and rollers at that time did not want to hear Run DMC.
What did you think of it personally?
Didn't care for it. Like it much better now. You know, as time gone by, like I like the Beastie Boys now too. It's like I'm a little late on that, but yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a good song. Yeah.
She was wonderful, as was Dennis Constantine, formerly of KBCO, who was just the architect of the AAA format. So that was a great talk with him.
Between KZY and KBPI, then tightening down to 185 songs, I felt there was an opportunity for a station that could be in the spirit of progressive, the old progressive stations, but more focused on being a local, being connected to the local music scene, because Colorado had a very active music scene at the time. And it was Michael Murphy, Dan Fogelberg, Stephen Stills, you know, Judy Collins, all these singer-songwriters were living in Colorado. And so we created this station that kind of was singer-songwriter based. And then right after we went on the air, that was 1977, new wave and punk hit. So we thought, well, you know, this kind of fits. And so we started working that music in, and it became a full service kind of like new rock and acoustic station. it was an eclectic mix, but it worked. And Denver loved it.
Who else we got?
Oh, we talked to Buzz Knight, a radio guy. He's radio through and through. He came and talked to us, and he has his own podcast now, also Taking a Walk podcast.
Yes, I cleverly titled that episode Having a Sit with Buzz Knight.
That was very clever.
Yeah, all our episodes have clever wordplay.
They do. Thanks,
guaranteed.
Dave.
Guaranteed to have clever wordplay. Clever is in quotes and should always be in quotes. Whenever I talk, I use the quotes.
I think you're clever. I don't think you are clever. I think you are actually clever.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And speaking of clever, how about topping our K-Rock countdown off last year with Comedy Bang Bang's Scott Aukerman? Number four, Drama-Rama, Anything, Anything. In parentheses, I'll give you.
I'll give you. Yeah. Didn't the lead singer have a Beatles radio show for a long time, too?
No, you're thinking of Chris Carter. Chris Carter was in Drama-Rama.
Chris Carter, he also created the X-Files. So it's like, you know, Drama-Rama's had a huge influence on pop culture.
Yes, indeed they have. My question to you was, have you ever gifted anyone something, someone something a little embarrassing or anything like that? Have you given your wife something like, oh, that was a big...
Yeah, my wife, I found out pretty early on in our relationship that I was not allowed to buy purses for her.
Okay.
Because the look of disgust on her face, because I would see a purse in like a department store and go, oh, that looks cool. Oh, I'll buy her a purse for Christmas. And then she'd get it and go like, ugh. And then I look at the purses she buys and I'm like, that looks like shit too. Like, what is the difference here? But I don't have the eyes for it, I guess, because she'll look at one person and go like, that's gorgeous. And she'll look at another person and say, this looks like a piece of shit. So I don't. And there's no difference between the two to me. So I'm not allowed to buy purses anymore.
I'm impressed that you ever were, that you actually went into a store and thought, oh, this looks really nice. I think I'll buy it.
You would think that there would be some sort of, grace with that. The fact that I tried. But no, yes. There was none. There was none. It was just pure hatred for the purse.
That's mad respect to your wife for like, look,
this is something you can't do. Please
that's
don't.
That's one way to look at it.
Nice yeah. try.
Yeah, it was great. We talked to all these people and at 10 songs at a time, and we got their whole backstory and, you know, learned a little bit. And we're the much better people for having heard their stories.
We're fuller. We are definitely fuller. Fuller people.
Yes.
More well-rounded.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to find out who we're going to talk to about 1987.
Me too.
How far ahead are we? So we're 2024. We're talking about 1987.
30.
The year 2000.
33 years.
33 years. All right.
So we have a 33 year span.
33, like 33 1/3. That's how we'll remember it.
Yes.
All right. Very good. So what happened in 2023 with the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
Oh, we got to speak to a lot of the artists that we saw then perform, which was really fun. Like The Church. We talked to Steve Kilby.
Yeah. One of our most popular episodes, Steve Kilby of The Church.
Yeah. Is it The Hypnogogue?
The Hypnogogue. Yeah.
It's like a, what do you call it? Like a Rush 2112.
Yeah. It was a concept album.
Concept.
Yes. We love the concept albums. The Church are doing concept albums in 2023.
He had that dry sense of humor.
Of course, I look at Wikipedia, which never lies. And it said you sang a verse of Old Man Emu by the Australian country music artist John Williamson. I looked that up and it's like a kid's song. Did you sing that song and why? And does it have some significance for you?
I'm going to give you a performance of it right now with the Australian accent. Please okay. note that I'm an Englishman, so I find amusement in speaking like this. You silly galah, I'm better by far than a white cockatoo or a budgerigar. They squeak and squawk and try and talk. Why, me and them's like cheese and chalk. Did you like that?
I loved it.
I think you should be doing voiceovers.
If that song was a huge hit when I was about 15, and I guess I've got five daughters, and as each of they came in twins, so I had two lots of twins, I would amuse them. Because you start grasping at straws sometimes to amuse your kids too. And I found this one was very efficacious to do the, you stupid galah, to do the bird thing about an emu. The kids would be temporarily amused by that and stop sticking forks in the power sockets while I did my various poems. I also taught them all kinds of things. They could rap punk songs, and I also taught them this one. Are you ready for this? I've got a knife for strife, I've got a gun for fun, I get money from my mum, but you can't get none because I'm a hoodlum. Hoodlum. I used to have all my kids saying that, like my posse behind me. That was an Australian punk band. I also had them doing Cherry Bomb. They loved that one. Hello, Daddy. Hello, Mom. I'm your ch-ch-ch. And they love Suzy Quattro as well. 48 crash. So all my kids were raised with like the sputum and detritus of all the lyrics and stupid songs going round and round in their father's head. I'd sit them down and teach it to them. And it amused me to see them parrot all this stuff, you know, like this ridiculous, bizarre, random lyrics that I had accumulated over a lifetime, to see all my daughters saying this stuff. It amused me.
Yeah, that was fun. And then we saw Glenn Matlock. We talked to him first and then we saw him.
Yeah.
Was there someone that was pretty vacant, or who was this? What did you write about? Who was the person?
I wrote that song because Malcolm had been going backwards and forwards to New York and had told us there was this scene over there. Now the bands that were coming through, like the early Heartbreakers and Television, and maybe the Ramones were beginning to go down, but they hadn't made any records, so we had no idea what they sounded like. And Malcolm brought back this kind of list of songs that he pinned up on the wall in his shop. He would put like postcards from people up and things, and there was a list of songs. And the first song was open brackets, In the Arms of, closed brackets, and then Venus de Milo, which I thought was a bit weird because I was at art school at that time, and I know the statue of Venus de Milo has got, by David, has got no arms because they've fallen off. So I thought, well, that was kind of a weird idea. And then the next song on this list was Blank Generation. And that kind of got me thinking, and what was going on in England and London was, it's pretty much akin to what's going on now. You know, it did seem this air of, if you don't grab the bull by the horns and do something for yourself, you're going to come unstuck. So it gave me the pretty vacant idea, but I hadn't heard any of their music then. So that was kind of quite a good cultural kind of little spark to give you an idea, you know.
Saw him at the Roxy. That was great because he played with a number of other amazing musicians that we love, like Clem Burke and Gilby Clark.
Are you forgetting that Kathy Valentine played with him?
I did. I did completely.
We never forget about Kathy Valentine.
Well, we did. Glenn Matlock has his album Consequences coming. That is worth checking out. We had a great time at the show because we had all these amazing musicians and he plays Sex Pistols songs.
Kathy played some songs.
And Kathy played her songs too. I believe she played Can't Stop the World.
I believe she did.
We saw that. We saw that. I believe we saw that. I believe a little lot.
I believe we can fly.
Yeah. All right. I believe it's time for a break. We're having some fun reminiscing on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. But I believe now is the time to take a break. We will be back shortly.
And we're back on the What Difference Does It Make podcast, looking back at 2023.
We also saw the Cruel World's Fest.
We did see the Cruel World Fest.
And we also went with friends of the show. We met a couple of friends of the show there. We went with our friend, Craig Rosen. And then we met friend of the show,
Jake Rude.
Of Twin Cities fame, yes.
Jake is like the Richard Blade of the Twin Cities and more.
No one does more than Richard Blade. Yeah. But yes, very cool to see Jake.
I don't have a cat. This is my buddy that sits next to me all day. This is Harry.
Harry!
Named after Mr. Stiles?
Harry Connick Jr., as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Yeah. Harry Bennett, also named after Tony Bennett. He likes to croon, and we love our crooners around here. So that was my first radio station experience, was KFJM AM 1370 Grand Forks. I was a big band, a swing, and I guess crooner DJ in early college. I was just obsessed with Frank Sinatra and Harry Connick Jr. And it was a jazz station. It was my first gig. So it was a nice fit.
Wait, was this during the swing era? Like when the Voodoo Daddies?
Before Cherry Poppin' Daddies, before Squirrel Nut Zippers. Yeah, that was probably mid 90s? This would have been 93. So I don't know when those guys hit the scene, but.
When everyone was going grunge, you were.
Going crooner.
Yeah. No, I respect all those grunge bands and, you know, I've got a handful of favorites, but I've always been an 80s guy.
Yeah, we had just talked to him like a couple of weeks ago and boom, there he was.
In the flesh.
In the flesh. We don't talk to people in the flesh too much. I mean, you know, I don't talk to you in the flesh too much.
I know. That's why this is such a treat.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Okay. You say that sarcastically, but I meant it.
Okay. Thank you.
My feelings are hurt. Although really your feelings should be, you could be extra mean. You gave me a holiday gift and I gave you nothing.
Yeah, well.
Gave you a lump of coal.
That's the only reason I give gifts, so I can make people feel bad about themselves. What happened at the Cruel World Fest that was memorable? Besides all the bands?
The bands that we saw, so we want to just go right to the thunder and lightning.
Yeah, they kicked us out. All right, kids, you've had enough fun. Now get the hell out of here.
We got through the whole day. We knew it was supposed to rain all day. There was a chance. It was in the forecast. Brookside at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California. No. Iggy played a few songs.
Yeah.
And then it was shut down. So we missed the headliners.
Yeah. Susie Sue. So we missed Iggy. We only saw like three songs of Iggy and they pulled the plug and then we missed. And then Susie never got to go on. And then, they kick us out and like, all right, well, I guess that's the end of that. And everyone's upset. And then less than, 12 hours later, we get a note saying,
you can come back
tomorrow.
So we went back and we saw Iggy do a full set. We saw Susie do a full set. And we saw Gary Newman do a full set.
Yes,
also, and for those who chose, because Gary Newman did play, I think we split up during this time, right? And someone went to see Gary and someone went to see someone else, but he came back and played a full set also, which was really cool.
Yeah. No crossover with bands. He got to, that's a three artist set right there, which is actually, I would have probably paid the same amount of money just to see those three.
Yeah. That was spectacular. That was a really cool thing to do. And they didn't charge for parking again.
That's true. Yeah. So
that's a bonus.
Good on Golden Voice. Good on you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we talked about this then, but now in hindsight, all these many months later, do you have a favorite?
A favorite from
Cruel World, a favorite artist that you saw?
I love Diggy.
And we saw some good. We saw ABC. We saw Modern English. We saw Gang of Four. We saw The Vapors.
Yeah. So the Cruel World Fest is. It's fun. It's fun.
It's more than fun.
It's a good time. I'm cooling off on festivals, I think. I'm reaching that age.
But I think when this comes along again, if you don't go, you might have FOMO.
Well, I might. We'll see. I don't know.
We'll play it by ear.
I know. I'm at the age where like, all right, fine. I don't need... But we'll see.
Okay. You can just sit with that for a little while. You don't have to make any rash decisions. But we did see... We did see a few other artists this year.
Oh, yeah? Who'd we see?
We saw Depeche Mode.
We did see Depeche Mode. That was great.
Yeah.
However,
yeah,
I made the biggest mistake. And I will never do this again.
What mistake did you make?
I will never eat at the Sizzler again.
Oh.
I thought it was, I had a FOMO of, I wish I can go back in time and remove this.
Was it that bad?
Oh.
It was, well, I mean, we ate there together, but whatever happened to you?
It was not, you know, how you mentioned this is, you know, cozy and warm and inviting. I didn't get any of those feelings. I wanted that feeling when I went to Sizzler. I did not. I felt like, oh my God, I got to get out of here. This is just a horrible, horrible place.
Okay. So Sizzler, for those not familiar with it.
Everyone knows Sizzler.
Is it a nationwide chain?
I think so. Worldwide? Okay. Yeah, it is. Where you get the crappy steak. And it used to be like you can get your crappy steak, but you get like the toast and the salad bar was like, it was like, it was a party. It was a party salad bar. It was really amazing. Like so many great things.
We used to go there when we were young adults. It was a less expensive meal.
Right.
For what you get.
For what you get.
And there is still one Sizzler. Well, there are a few, I think, but this one happens to be across the street from the Kia Forum where we saw Depeche Mode.
I like how you have to say the Kia Forum. You can't just say the Forum.
You can't just Kia just call pay
it the fabulous. Just call it the fabulous Forum.
Yeah. Not even the Great Western Forum.
Sure, you can call it the.
Yeah, across the street from the Forum where we saw Depeche Mode. That's where Sizzler was. And all these years, I told you then that Steve and I talk about going, we should just go there one day before the show. We haven't been there since we were probably in college.
Right. Where you have warm feelings of like. Yeah.
But we never did. So yeah, I went with you.
Which was smart. But once the music started, like, I forgot all about it until like the next morning. I'm like, oh my God, what did I do last night?
We did it.
Okay, oh my God.
We don't have to go back. But we also had, you had a beer and I had some wine and it was like a third of the price that it would have been at the Forum.
Next time, if we go to the Sizzler, I will just get a beer.
Okay. All right. Enough Sizzler talk. Depeche Mode was fucking awesome though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're great. I keep doing the Dave Gahan spin now.
Dave's got spread the dance down.
Just whirly, whirly, just...
Like a whirling dervish.
Yeah, just spread your arms out as wide as you can and then just spin around. Just keep spinning.
Not sure if anyone but Dave Gahan could pull that off.
Yeah. Oh, I can.
Yeah, you can. That's true. Dave Gahan and Dave Sloan.
Yeah, there you go. Can't imagine Robert Smith of The Cure doing that.
No. Iggy.
No, Iggy wouldn't do that.
It's too choreographed for Iggy.
No, yeah, Iggy. Did you enjoy the Cure show?
Cure. Stuff happened at the Cure.
Stuff
happened. I'm told.
What were you doing?
Tell me an event that happened at the Cure.
Well, no, we had some nice seats, and when the Cure went into Love Song, I looked behind me, and the couple behind me, the guy was proposing to his soon-to-be fiancé, apparently.
She said yes.
It looked like she did because I took a picture and I have this random picture of these random people who I don't know who they are. But if you're listening to this podcast, I have a photo of you, of your first photo as a man and fiance.
We were literally.
What do you say?
You were as a
fiancé and fiance.
They were literally in our box. Well, yeah. We were in a box together.
Yes. And then I turned around and they were gone, of course. Because once you're married or once you're proposed, you can't just sit there.
You have to consummate it.
You got to start planning the wedding. Yeah. Fortunately, they did not consummate their engagement in the box.
Fortunately for that. That was great. That was
Yeah. Very, very good night. There was a great reissue of The Replacements, Tim. And so we got to speak to Peter Jespersen, who was the first manager of The Replacements, the most important manager of The Replacements, and also headed up Twin Tone Records. And he had a book out, and we got to talk to him. Were you part of the recording process during Tim?
I was. You know, initially, I mean, literally the night before we were going in to start the record, we had a meeting at my apartment and with Tommy Erdely, and all of a sudden Westerberg said, oh, by the way, we don't want you in the studio while we're making this record. And it was like knife in the heart kind of thing. And then as the band, after they'd finished the tracking, and it was just Paul and the engineer and Tommy Erdely in the studio, somehow Paul kind of invited me back. You know, we went through our ups and downs, but we always circled back to being friends. And I think one of the key moments was that I had been talking to the A&R guy from Warner's, Michael Hill. And I've been talking to Michael, and he said to me, hey, has Paul done the solo song yet? And I said, well, there isn't a solo song for this record that I know of anyway. And he said, oh, no, Paul told me he's got one. And that was kind of like weird, because usually I'd be the first person Paul would talk to about these solo songs. And so I kind of went into the, you know, the studio where Paul was at one point, was kind of going, so you're holding out on me, I hear. Michael says, you got a solo song. And Paul got physically nervous right away. He got really like uncomfortable. There was no question about it. And I was like, wow, what's happening here? And he kind of like tried to sort of push it off, you know, deny it or whatever for a minute. And then all of a sudden he said, God damn it. Yep, I do have one and let's do it. And I got an acoustic guitar here. We immediately said, okay, I want to cover up the window to the control room. Come here. And he and I pulled these big choir baffles that they had in the studio for other, you know, the studio did recorded, you know, orchestras and choirs and stuff. They had these big, huge choir baffles and we moved them. They're on wheels. We moved them to block the window. And then I pulled one chair to the middle of the room and Paul sat down and Steve Felstead, the engineer, brought out a microphone for the guitar and a microphone for Paul's voice. And then he went back into the control room and I was like, okay, Paul, are you ready? Everything, you need anything else? You need a bottle of water? You need a beer, whatever? He said, no, I'm good. And as I walked out, he said, turn the lights down. I want it almost pitch black. So as I went out, I took the fader on the light switch and brought it way, way down. I could barely see him in the middle of the big studio room. And then we went into the control room and hit record. And he did Here Comes a Regular. And there's three grown men in the control room with tears going down our cheeks. I mean, it was like, you know, one of the most powerful experiences I ever had. It was just absolutely breathtaking.
That was cool because I could talk Replacements all the time.
So, yeah, we talked to Peter Jespersen. We talked to a lot of other authors as well, right?
Yes, we did talk to a lot of authors. Name me one or two or three.
Well, Annie Zaleski.
Annie Zaleski, our favorite. Who actually, she put out two books this year that we talked to her about.
She did. We talked to her first earlier in the year about her book on Pink.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, that was a treat for me. Thank you for indulging me on that. You know, she's, you know, outside of our normal realm, but you know.
There is no realm. Huge. What difference does it make, right?
What difference does it make?
Yeah.
If I would say, give me a Pink song, I don't know anything about her. Can you tell me?
Oh, not anything. See, if I'm telling people, like, if you don't know anything about her, listen to Raise Your Glass, Get the Party Started. You know, Just Like a Pill is like a really powerful song. You know, What About Us? Who knew? Like, I would say she's one of those artists you can say the hits are really good. Like, start with the hits, get a greatest hits record. That's a real good sort of encapsulation of what she's about. Because, I mean, my God, like, she just has so many good songs. Like, it's difficult to, you know, narrow it down, honestly.
So that was awesome. But we also had her back during the holidays. She has a Christmas music song by song.
Right. So thank you for indulging me on that.
That was my pleasure because I love you. I love Annie. We know that I don't love Christmas music so much. You helped me turn a corner.
Not fully engaged in the corner, but the corner is turned.
No, I'm there. I'm on the Christmas music train, sort of.
Sort of. Yeah, that's right. You did discover Father Christmas by the Kinks. That's your new favorite song.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, this wasn't in the book, but we know Alanis covering Last Christmas. is also among my favorites.
Well, Last Christmas, number one Christmas song of the UK this year.
They got there.
In 2023.
He got there.
They got there.
They got there.
Yeah. So well-deserved by Wham. There was also the Wham documentary. Did you watch that in 2023?
Hell yeah. I thought that was beautiful. Yeah. How about you?
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Yeah.
Really good. It's what helps these guys get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. You have to put out a documentary before you get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now.
It seems that way. It's just kind of reminding the board or whatever.
Yeah, whoever is in charge. Yeah. It's kind of ridiculous now, but.
You got to remember that the Go-Go's, their documentary, yeah.
Yeah, that's how it's done. Let's see. Okay, so that was one. We talked to Annie Zaleski, name on that. And give me another one.
Oh, we talked to Jason Thomas Gordon.
That was one of my favorite episodes.
He wrote the book called The Singers Talk.
Yes. And what do the singers talk about?
The singers talk about their voices, which is super cool. And I hope I'm not overusing that, but it was it was really interesting to hear him. Jason Thomas Gordon is a musician. He's a singer also. And so he talked to singers, a lot of singers, everyone that we were familiar with, about their voices.
Talked to Robert Smith of The Cure.
Yeah.
Talked to Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. Talked to Tom York of Radiohead. Talk to Bryan Adams, your favorite.
So sort of along the same lines as where you're singing from, you talk about warm-up. You know, you asked the artists about their warm-ups, and there were some particularly funny ones like Joan Jett, Squeaky Door, and Perry Farrell, the Kermit.
Yeah.
Did they do these for you? Did they demonstrate this for you on the phone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, hopefully... Hopefully everybody signs off on a podcast eventually and we can get some of this out there to people. We'll see what happens. But I mean, yeah, so many singers were singing, breaking into song, showing me their warm-ups, you know, saying them out loud. Perry had me singing like Kermit. You know, it was just incredible. And so it's like, okay, next show, do I try to warm up like Kermit the Frog and see how I sing that night? You know, so now you have all these, again, you're picking and choosing. Okay, that didn't really work, you know, for me. Well, maybe I'll try the Perry Farrell Kermit the Frog approach and see if that works for me.
And the squeaky door, try this.
And the squeaky door, yeah. Joan Jett does a little squeaky door thing. She says she does on stage and, you know, she's having trouble on stage, she'll just do it and turn away from the mic and make this sound like a squeaky door and stick her tongue out. And she's like, I don't care if it looks stupid. That's what I'm doing.
And also the proceeds of this book go to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital and Music Gives to St. Jude. And yeah, he was great to talk to. He has his own band, King Size.
Yeah, good band. Their single is Pain Reliever. We're checking out.
Yeah.
He's got a good voice. He knows how to use it. He's learned from the best. And, you know, we got to talk to a couple rock stars.
We talked to a lot of rock stars.
Deborah Ayal. You remember her?
From Romeo Void.
From Romeo Void. Your appearance on American Bandstand. I just watched that. And you made mention of your coat that you wore with the artistic. What was the story behind the jacket? And
Well, Frank went and did that. Frank made that happen. He went out, I'm pretty sure he bought all the jackets and painted them Jackson Pollock style. And that was something that he thought, you know, just be a great look for us to wear. I wore mine, you know, on American Bandstand. And I got to make Dick Clark laugh. You know, when I said, well, we made it onto Bandstand, and he does this wiggle. His whole body does this undulation. It's really cool. So that's like my claim to fame. I made Dick Clark undulate.
She was delightful.
Indeed. Yeah. She had some great insights into the San Francisco scene. We learned a lot about, where we go? We went to San Francisco, learned about the scene from Deborah. We went to Philadelphia. We talked with Dane Sabatino of the Dead Milkmen, learned about the Philadelphia scene.
When we started to play shows, the Milkmen did. I joined the Milkmen in 1983, and we started playing shows. It was an interesting scene because there were lots of all ages hardcore shows with hardcore bands coming through town, basically booking their shows through the back pages of Maximum Rock and Roll. We were friends with the guy who booked shows, Chuck Meehan booked shows here, and his shows were great because he wasn't afraid to mix it up a little bit. Like, we weren't really a hardcore band, and we never were. But we were on these bills with hardcore bands, and that's how we got our start. So I, you know, I think it was great that Philadelphia kind of welcomed all kinds of different styles. So it was very varied, very friendly. You know, we played shows where, you know, you could get a dollar off your ticket price, which was probably only $3 or $4 if you brought a can of food for the homeless and that kind of thing. So, and then, you know, we played those shows for a few years, and then we scraped enough money together to get an album together and put it out in 1985, you know, and then we too booked our shows all over the country using the back pages of Maximum Rock and Roll.
You talk to rock stars, they give you what's going on. They give you the truth.
And we talked to Jock Bartley too of Firefall.
Yeah, so he talked to us about the Boulder scene. That was a good one too. Jock Bartley, he's great.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these guys are like, you want to talk to the singer of Firefall? Like, maybe, sure. We're like, we look at each other like, well, this could be interesting. And it was more than interesting. It was fascinating. And he's a great storyteller. That's all you really want.
Yeah.
You want someone who could tell a great story. And that was Jock.
When Rick Roberts replaced Gram Parsons in the Flying Burrito Brothers, Burritos played in Washington, D.C. And after the show, Rick Roberts, the new lead vocalist, went to this club to hear this phenomenal female singer, Emmy Lou Harris. And Rick basically discovered Emmy Lou, and he called Chris back at the hotel, and Chris said, I'm already in bed. No, I'm not going to come down. And Chris going, you got to come here, see her. And Chris kind of goes, and he takes a cab down, and they see Emmy Lou Harris for the first time being a folk singer in Washington, D.C. And a few days later, Chris Hillman called Gram Parsons, his old buddy from the Byrds and the Burrito Brothers, and said, I think we might have found the gal you're looking for. And a year or so later, Gram and Emmy Lou and the Fallen Angels, with a guitar player who had just joined the band, they wanted Gram and everybody wanted James Burton, who had played all over the Gram's records, you know. But Elvis said, you're not going out with anybody else. You're my guitar player. So they said, okay. Oh, hey, how about Clarence White? And Clarence White was with the Byrds then. You know, so the two top guitar players they wanted to hire weren't available, and they hired a guy kind of sight unseen in the 11th hour, and they got in the bus and drove to their first gig in Boulder, Colorado. And I got a call from the manager of the club that they were going to play at and said, Jock, you better get down here. You might have a gig. And I went, who with? And he said, Gram Parsons. And I went, who? And he said, you know, the Flying Burrito Brothers, the Byrds. Oh, yeah. Okay, great. I went down there and I watched their first gig. And the guitar player that they had was mostly a acoustic player. And he was real nervous and got drunk. And they knew they needed to find a guitar player. And I got asked to sit in with them the next night. And I did. And fortunately for me, the band that was opening the show was kind of a 50s rock band that I'd go sit in and just play great at on the, you know, be a rock guy, rah, you know, do what I do. So they saw that I could play. Then I, you know, and they took a vote after the show and said, well, we need a really good rhythm guitar player. Number two, we need a good rock guitar player, soloist who can play on our rock stuff. But mostly we need a really great country picker, a la James Burton, right? And all the records, right? And they looked at it, and I was a terrible country picker. I had no experience in that at all. But I was the first two, and they said, well, 2 out of 3 is better than 0 out of 3, and I got hired. Aww. And the next morning at 9 a.m., the bus left for Austin, Texas. And I remember the late, great steel player Neil Flans and I in the back of the bus trying to drop the needle on the turntable so I could try to learn that particular James Burton lick and stuff. Yeah. The end of this little part of the story is that the second gig we played in Liberty Hall in Houston, we're playing our set, and onto the stage walk Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt. Ooh. And it was the first time Emmy Lou Harris and Linda ever met or sang together. And, you know, and after we played, Neil says, hey, I'm having a party back in my hotel suite. Come on over. And so 3 bands, Neil Young's band, Linda Ronstadt's band, and Graham Parsons Band with Emmylou Harris go back to Neil's palatial suite in Houston. Mass quantities of everything, stay up till dawn just about. But the most amazing thing was Graham, as he was wont to do, grabbed the guitar of Neil's and started playing like 20 country songs, you know, by the Leuven brothers and stuff, who I'd never heard of before, you know. But what was amazing was about 5 feet away from Graham, Linda and Emmylou sat face to face about 6 inches apart, nose to nose, and blended their voices together for the very first time. And it was not only magical, but we all knew it was historic. It's like, wow.
And that they have a great sense of humor, like Howard Jones.
Howard Jones, indeed. Howard Jones was a fun get. Actually, Howard Jones wasn't the fun get. The fun get was the fan of Howard Jones. He has a book called We're In This Together, where fans wrote their personal stories related to Howard Jones. And so like an hour before our interview with Howard, I was thinking, oh, we should talk to, maybe we can reach out to a fan from LA. So I scanned the book for K-Rock. There was only one person who mentioned K-Rock, which is shocking because when I think of Howard Jones music, I feel like this was the launching pad for him, was in Los Angeles. But it was this one woman, Dorit, and I looked her up on Facebook, and sure enough, I had a connection with her, a friend who knew her. So I sent her a DM saying, hey, you want to talk to Howard Jones? And 15 minutes later, she responded with, yeah, I want to talk to Howard Jones. She, of course, did some quick checking up on me to make sure I was legit. But it worked out well. And so she got to talk to probably her favorite artist is Howard Jones. But Dorit is. And so she told her story and, you know, just everything about why she loved Howard Jones. And I think that made that episode really special. So it was one of the highlights of last year.
Hi, Dorit.
Hello.
You're on with Howard Jones.
Hi, Howard.
Hi, Dorit. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Not so bad. I'm in a day off at the moment, trying to rest.
So we're hoping you might tell us how you ended up submitting your experiences to the book.
Well, so I've been a fan for a very, very, very long time, and I follow Howard Jones on social media, and I saw the request for fan stories, and I've seen him so many times over the years that so many things have happened at shows that I felt compelled to share my stories. Even afterwards, I'm like, oh my God, I have new stories because I just saw Howard Jones in Chula Vista when we had Hurricane Hillary, and I almost didn't go because I live in the LA area. And I'm like, oh, I have more stories to share.
But your first experience was at Universal Amphitheater.
Yeah. So my best friend had won pit tickets to see Howard Jones at the Universal Amphitheater, which is sadly no longer a venue. And we were so excited, and we were in the front row and dancing and singing. And it was just like the best experience ever. That was my first time seeing Howard Jones. And yeah, I was so shocked when he was coming to Warner Center, one of our local free concerts in the parks, because unheard of to get names like Howard Jones. And the story I submitted is about how I was kind of mortified. We met some friends there. We all had our kids with us. Our kids were pretty young at the time, and I got there super, super early, Howard, because I wanted to be up front and to have the best spot to be able to see you and hear you and dance and sing. And there was like this chain link fence thrown across to provide a barrier between where the fans were going to be. And there was a grassy area and then the stage and security, and the kids were playing with the chain. So I had my kids sit down and we were picnicking and just kept giving them snacks to keep them occupied. But my friend's kids were out of control, and the security guard came over and talked to us a couple times. And I was so afraid that we were going to get kicked out or asked to leave or asked to move. So I kept distancing from those friends. I kept moving over a little bit more, because I didn't want to get in trouble because of their kids. And I'm like, I'm not moving. I want this spot.
Great. That's great. You did that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Stick to your guns and hold your ground.
She was great, and we got lucky because she was articulate and had a lot to contribute. Sure. So that was fun. That was
all Howard Jones fans are like that.
He seems like a really genuine guy. Loved the stories that we loved hearing about his mom, you know, who ran his fan club, and just a whole family thing, you know, whole family vibe.
You know what's a cool family?
Sly and the Family Stone?
No, the immediate family.
The immediate family. Denny Tedesco's film. I loved it.
Yes. Yeah, it's out now, and you could see it in theaters. And I'm sure it's streaming everywhere. But if it's not in theaters anymore, it's streaming and available. And so worth your time, because the immediate family is Russ Kunkel.
Waddy Wachtel.
Go ahead. So, Holly, go ahead. So we got Russ Kunkel, Waddy Wachtel.
Danny Kortchmar.
Danny Kortchmar. Leland Sklar. Lee. And we have Steve Postel.
Very good. We talked to them a few years ago, early on in the pandemic, when they were still making pandemic music. And we knew this film
music. That was great.
So I'm sure you guys know they are the session musicians of the 70s and early 80s. They played with everybody, all our favorite artists.
Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Stevie Nicks.
Everybody. Don Henley.
Carole King. James Taylor, on and on and on. Anyway, so we talked to them in 2020 and they were talking about this film and we're like, okay, yeah, sounds great, blah, blah, blah. And then sure enough, Denny Tedesco, who created the Wrecking Crew documentary, his follow-up is this film about the immediate family.
When the guys, when Jack and Greg and Jonathan, my producers, came to me with this idea, and I said, oh, this sounds great. I love this idea because about these guys that have this band called The Immediate Family. And I knew who the guys were. I mean, they're legends. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of Wrecking Crew, I added that line with a VO was, this is a story about my father and his extended family, the Wrecking Crew. They were a family. Mm-hmm. You know, they see more of each other than their own families, you know, when you're working and stuff. And that lasted a good 10 years for them. And then with this one, with the fact that they have this band called Immediate Family, I said, oh, there's a nice spin there. There we go. And then the other thing is, Lou Adler says at the end of Wrecking Crew, the question to him was, did you make a change in your sound? Did you consciously hire new musicians when you did Tapestry? He goes, oh, no. He goes, Carol brought in Cooch and James, her friend, you know, James Taylor. They were her friends. So that song of it's too late. I can't hear a lyric to save my life, by the way. I can't hear lyrics unless it's written out. I can't tell you what it says. You too?
Yes. You mean when you're listening to music?
Yes.
Yeah. Same. It's the music to me. It is less.
I can hear the riffs. I can hear the beats. Mm-hmm. I can hear Danny's solo, and I know Danny's solo. I could scat Danny's solo. You know, I can't play guitar, by the way, but I can, you know what I mean? And so that was like one of my favorite songs. That album is such a beautiful album. Mm-hmm. So I was excited about it. And then Danny was the first one. We set up Carole King. And Carol wanted Danny with her. So that's why Danny's in that.
Oh,
that's
nice.
Why. And it made sense. And it was great. Yeah. And that's the relationship.
And he did this was also a labor of love. He'd been working on it for many, many, many years. He had to get creative with the funding. He really wanted to make this happen. And finally, it got bought and it has been released. Denny does a really great job telling each of their stories. So highly recommend. That's a thumbs up.
Big thumbs up. All right. Yeah. As I was talking about movies, we also talked to a trio of documentarians, and they created Joan Baez, I Am a Noise. So Denny came to the garage. We also had Emil Spolder came to the garage to talk about his documentary on the Dream Syndicate. And that was great because, like, this guy from a foreign country just came into Sherman Oaks garage, sight unseen. Like, all right, I'm just going to come here. Do-do-do-do. And there he was. And it was great.
Yeah, Emil is from the Netherlands. And this film, which has now been released, I believe, right?
Yeah, it's out. Yeah, it's streaming now.
Yeah, it had been screening. There have been some screenings around the country. But he was on vacation. He was basically on vacation with his girlfriend. And he just showed up in Sherman Oaks.
Yeah. Work is never done. We'll always be closing.
Dream Syndicate. Why?
Your origin story for Dream Syndicate.
It all started in 2003 at the famous Paradiso in Amsterdam, this concert venue. I was 19 at the moment, and I was a huge Ryan Adams fan. And it was my first time seeing Ryan Adams perform. I was very excited going there. But it was Steve Wynn and the Miracle 3 mm-hmm. opening for Ryan Adams. And the opening band was either equally as good or maybe even better than the main act. So I was very impressed with the band and started following Steve Wynn in the years after. Mm. And after shows, he's usually performing in smaller concert venues around Europe, the 200-300 seat places. And after the shows, he's always very approachable and you can talk to him at merch stand. So I talked to him quite a few times after the shows, and I also had a music television show at a local TV station called Music in the Backyard. This helped me to get in touch with a lot of musicians and also Steve Wynn. In 2009, when I was living in Los Angeles for a year, I was studying film here. Mm-hmm. The first week I was here, Steve Wynn was performing at the Troubadour with his band, The Baseball Project. He has this band together with...
My favorite.
Yeah.
I love those guys.
Yeah. His band together with his wife, Linda Pittman, and the guys from REM.
Who I love. I have Linda on my shirt.
Oh, nice, nice. I walked in the venue, and I walked right into Steve Wynn, and he recognized me, and he introduced me to his friends and family, who were also at the show, since he's originally from Los Angeles. And I started talking to his friends, and at a certain moment, I was talking to his mom, and I told her I was starting film school here in a few weeks, and she just said it at a certain point, well, would it be nice if someone ever makes a movie about my son? And in the coming weeks, I started thinking about it. It always was my dream to make a music documentary, and this seemed like a really interesting subject, and Steve seemed to be pretty down with the idea. I really want to do this project, and I want to meet all these musicians and hear their stories.
So yeah, we talked to a number of documentarians. That was, wow.
But also, I don't know if you would call him a documentarian, but we talked to Mark Altman.
Oh, that's right. That was the other one. Greatest Geek Year Ever, which was 1982.
This was a TV show streaming on...
It was TBS, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think you could still watch The Greatest Geek Year Ever.
Yeah, that was fun. It was fun talking to him about it.
Oh yeah, he's a geek himself. So it was a good match.
Yeah.
We talk a little bit about movies, but this was an opportunity to focus solely on the movies.
At the end, we talked to a bunch of people about like what they think the best movie of 82 was. And, you know, my answer, it's going to bore you, is The Verdict. I thought The Verdict was the best movie of 82. I just love that movie. Sidney Lumet, directed it. I think it's really, you know, brilliantly written by David Mamet, and you know Paul Newman's so great in it. But you know, if we're gonna go with the geek stuff, I know that's really what you're asking. You know, Star Trek II is such a boring answer. Yes. I feel like maybe I would say Poltergeist because it's a horror movie that actually is about the characters and not just about what happens to the family, and it's so brilliantly executed. But man, genre, maybe Fast Times. It's such a smart movie. Amy Heckerling. You know what? I'm going to pick Diner. I'll pick Diner. How about that? I'm going with Diner. I love Diner. Yeah. I mean, I live that, you know, we all live that. I mean, you know, in my 20s, you know, and 30s, I mean, that was it. Going, you know, you're going to finish those fries and talking about what we talked about, movies, music, and, you know, girls and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and more French fries.
Yes, Poltergeist came out, The Thing.
Conan the Barbarian.
There you go. Yeah. So yeah, all your nerdy films came out. Grease 2, 48 Hours, so much good stuff. Anyway, 82 was a good year.
Yeah, but he
to do a documentary on, specifically on the movies. So yeah, we had a good time 2023.
We had a great time in 2023.
I'm looking forward to 2024 to be an excellent year.
I'm looking
forward to using better words. Better than excellent.
Should we start now? Should we start? We need to.
Why start now? We're still, I mean, technically we're recording in 2023, but this is in 2020. This will air in 2024.
All right.
We're still, so we can compare and contrast when we do this and, you know, record this again next year, we will know that we won't hear extraordinaire or excellent or.
Super
great,
cool.
Super cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. It was great.
It was great.
Well, it has been a great year. And thank you, Dave, for being my partner for yet another year. I'm so happy. There is no one I would rather do this with.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Same goes here. This has been, it's always wonderful, especially when we do it mano a mano, face to face.
Yeah, no, it is nice to see you. Maybe we can do some more in person this coming year.
If we can figure out how to do this configuration, it's this production, it's very intricate.
Yeah.
for a layperson like myself who can't figure out what's going on. But we managed to put together 37 episodes from 2023. Maybe we could do the same next year.
Here's to 37 more for 2024.
2024, 1986, 7, 1987, 2024, 19, or what is this?
37, 2024, 1987.
Okay. Oh, so many.
It's a lot of numbers.
Okay. But and what's the year difference?
33 years.
33 years. Okay. You're right.
We're looking at 33 years ago.
Okay. The year that was 33 years ago. All right. Well, I can't wait to see what happens. Congratulations. We got through this year.
It's more than getting through. We enjoyed this year. we didn't just get
through. We slogged through another year, Holly. Here's to another one.
We like doing this.
Yeah, we do indeed. I would toast with, I don't like toasting with water, but.
Is that really a thing?
Yeah, you don't toast with water.
Why?
Because it's empty. It's just, it's not, I don't know, it's just water. It's, yeah, I think it's like, in fact, I think it's bad luck.
I have no idea. So are we supposed to toast with salt and pepper shakers?
Sure.
That's okay. We can insert toast here.
Yeah, there you go. Well, here's to another year. Cheers to you, Holly. And until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.